Telehealth services have been more widely used to meet the needs of patients and the demand for healthcare. Virtual care continues to be an essential part of healthcare as clinicians look for ways to provide high-quality care from a distance. In this episode, we'll speak to two physicians and experts in telehealth, Dr. Graham McMahon and Dr. Andrew Watson of UPMC, to discuss how technology is redefining healthcare and the role that continuing education plays in supporting telemedicine. This is the Coffee with Graham podcast, and I'm your host, Melissa Simmons. In each episode, we'll discuss different issues and hot topics in healthcare with ACCME President and CEO, Dr. Graham McMahon. We'll also have guest interviews with our continuing education colleagues. These are monthly conversations that address local and national healthcare priorities. Thank you for listening. Hello, and thank you for joining us. Dr. Watson, how are you?
I'm very well, and thank you for asking me to join today. It's a real privilege.
And Graham, welcome back.
Great to be with you, Melissa, as always.
And now, Dr. Watson, can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Yes, and thank you for asking. I am an actively practicing surgeon here at UPMC, which is based in Pittsburgh. I operate solely on Crohn's and ulcerative colitis in the Division of Colorectal Surgery. But about 90% of my time is on the corporate side of healthcare, and I focus a lot on telemedicine and remote patient monitoring. And I've been at UPMC for 23 years, and my family's been here for about 100 years plus practicing medicine. I think relevant to this, I am the past president of the American Telemedicine Association, and I'm on the board of the American Board of Telehealth, and I'm happy to be here today. Thank you for asking me.
And Graham, can you share some of your background as it relates to telehealth?
Yeah, it's been an interesting journey for me. Like many clinicians, I've had to transition my practice to telecare over the last 8-9 months, and it's been a really remarkable transition for me. I had traditionally done both research and monitoring of patients using remote devices and services, particularly in relating to diabetes care and weight management, for example, but I've never had to do telecare the way I've had to do it now. So learning through that experience of how do you work with a team when you're working remotely, how do you communicate effectively with patients, how do you maintain documentation, how do you manage security, are all issues that I've had to navigate recently.
Now, Dr. Watson, can you give us some idea of the scope and the shift that we've seen, the shift to telehealth that we've seen emerge in the past year?
Yes, it's all that we had hoped, which for telemedicine to expand, but it's tragic that it took a pandemic to do this. Effectively, telemedicine has been around for many years. It's debatable, but you could say 2 decades plus. But really, in the late 1990s, it was gathering momentum. And a lot of the foundational work was in place, both with early platforms being developed, broadband connectivity, and the consumer electronics market getting us ready with Skype and FaceTime and video and wireless broadband. And COVID took about 20 years of hair pulling and about 22 weeks turned telemedicine into almost the only avenue of care delivery, as we all know. It really gave the healthcare industry a look full force at what telemedicine can do. Most of it was just replacing face-to-face with video visits, but there's other avenues such as remote monitoring that really were impactful. A lot of EICU care work was impactful. We had physicians here at UPMC supporting our colleagues in New York City. So what we saw was a huge transition of the healthcare industry almost instantaneously at the start of this tragic pandemic to full telemedicine. And now we've fallen back to about 20% of folks using telemedicine, but we're learning what the new norm will be. But in essence, we opened the curtains and saw the light shine in. And during a very sad time, telemedicine was really the straw that turned the proverbial drink. And it's very exciting for the field, but it's been a real tragedy for the world. And it's one of the few glimmers of hope in this pandemic.
Now, Graham, what are some of the reasons why clinicians might or might not prefer telehealth visits?
Well, I can tell you my experience and that of talking to several of my colleagues. Certainly, there's the concern and uncertainty about what is new or different. Every clinician worries that something new or different is going to be a challenge for them. It's taken a while for some clinicians to adopt and engage in using technology to work with their patients. But I think the reasons for those are not just the unfamiliarity of the technology for many clinicians, but the concerns that the communication or emotional connectedness that our patients have with us might be limited by the barrier of telemedicine. Having said that, there's also a whole lot of opportunities. Like Dr. Watson was mentioning, there are some silver linings here. I think many clinicians, myself included, are noting things like improved efficiency, increased availability, more straightforward communications, more availability of both patient and clinician. So patients aren't waiting in a waiting room. They're essentially waiting for their call, maybe doing their groceries, you know, who knows what they're doing, so they can maximize the efficiency, avoiding these geographical constraints that have traditionally typified physician-patient interaction. I think some of the concerns, though, that still persist are, well, how do you deliver care that requires psychomotor engagement with a patient, where you actually need to touch or observe something up close? How do you work with radiology or laboratories? How do you get patients to ensure that they get their testing done correctly and appropriately? And we're used to, as clinicians, talking with each other more readily in the corridor, for example, about more challenging patients or cases. And some of that is lost by the fact that we're now separated from each other as clinicians and from our team, as much as we are separated physically, at least from our patients.
He's right. Cultural change is quite difficult in healthcare. And it's a challenging part of who we are as physicians, because if you look back historically, physicians have said no to a couple things, such as hand washing, DNA, antibiotics, transplantation, laparoscopy, and EHRs. And this is just different. Telemedicine is hitting at the core of healthcare, because it's always been assumed, thought, that a face-to-face visit was essential to provide care. And that arguably goes back to Hippocrates, I think 400 BC. And so what's happened is that right now the consumer electronics market has told us what the patients and the health insurance members want, which is virtual. And they feel it's safer and more convenient, but not all of the time. There's no absolutes. And so I think you're seeing a lot of the change being actually coming from the organic patient side because of consumer electronics. And I just ask a rhetorical question: when's the time that anyone on this call voluntarily left their cell phone at home? And that shows you where we are as a society. So telemedicine is not an if, it's a matter of how much right now, and it's going to be a lot. It'll be well past the 50% mark.
Are there any risks to telehealth being more widely available?
The main fear is from the payer side about supply-induced demand. And this is a part of healthcare that goes back to theories in the 1980s. And there was a lot of fear about this around 2010, about if you open up telemedicine, you're going to create more access and more billing, and that it'll create unnecessary healthcare expense, which we simply haven't seen. One of the other challenges has been, how do we learn how to do a new examination? As Graham eloquently said, there's some differences in that sometimes you can't touch the patient yourself, but there's a whole new type of examination we have to learn. And that would be, how do you have somebody help you examine a patient remotely, or how do you use attached peripherals, so to speak? So there's a risk in that we have to learn a new way to examine our patients and change our ways. And the other risk is really the education of the next generation of medical students, residents, nurses, and APPs, that we need to find a way to include them in our training. So a couple things going on there, but there's a lot of activity in all of those areas.
As Dr. Watson just said, we need to think about the next generation of training clinicians. Graham, how have we seen CME and telehealth services integrate in recent months?
Well, I think, as you just heard, it's been a transformational experience for the majority of American doctors. That's no small statement, a transformational experience for the majority, if not almost all, American doctors in the last few months. As a result, you've created an enormous, and in many cases, largely unmet need of training opportunities for clinicians on how to do this right. The problem is that many clinicians assume that because they're so experienced with in-person visits, that a video visit is just a distant duplicate of that type of an encounter. When, of course, as Andrew will absolutely clarify, it is not the same. Now, many things are the same. Our ability to look each other in the eye, the ability to read each other's emotions, the ability to talk to each other in a way that we can understand each other, those are all persistent. But almost everything else is quite different. So helping clinicians to learn these skills so that they don't make assumptions, in many cases erroneous assumptions, about their own capabilities in this new area has been where there's been the greatest need. I've seen a variety of CME programs deployed and developed to address those needs, but I think uptake has been relatively modest given the massive need for this type of training. And I think most of it is because many clinicians make the erroneous assumption that they're perfectly good at doing this. But the what do you think, Andrew, about the capability of the American health professional workforce in delivering effective telecare? Would you give them an A? Would you give them a C? How do you think they're doing? Is there any way of knowing?
Yeah, Graham, you bring up a good point about how do we learn how to do this differently. It's important in the context of people are taking the time, hopefully, to listen to these interviews and for us to have this dialogue, is to look back not that long ago with laparoscopy, that we went from using scalpels to basically chopsticks and video cameras. Yeah. And using long sticks with graspers, and we stopped touching the patients and using staplers. And we've been through this before. It's just a matter of getting our hearts and minds around it up front. And I just think as a profession, we've got to be very careful stewards of our future because, again, this is coming from the consumer electronics market.
Yep.
Healthcare is encountering Google, Apple, Microsoft, Verizon, AT&T, Apple. That's who's driving this, not healthcare. So we really have, as you know also well, a tall order in front of us. And I do a lot of telemedicine, and my patients really like it. It's good for about probably 90, 95% of them, I would say, maybe more. I don't think we could grade them right now. There's been a heroic effort to get this far.
Yep.
That we will naturally gravitate back to a crouched position in an area of comfort, which is where we're moving a bit right now. But too much was seen, too much was done, too much was had in the COVID era. So there's been enough interested parties that will start moving forward in a more virtual direction. It is inevitable.
Dr. Watson, how do you view educational needs changing related to telerounding?
The way we include learners is very different now. We don't want to expose the learners to the sick patients, and also, you know, vice versa, depending on if the learners were exposed at a different rotation or the learners went to a social event they maybe should not have attended, or if the learners are immunosuppressed or the patients are immunosuppressed. There's a lot of different variables that you could list, but regardless, you've created this distance between the learning event and the learners, and you've also created an increased need for three-way didactic skills where you might have a patient here, a teacher there, and then in the third place, having a learner such as a medical student. So there's a lot that we're looking at from just a pure workflow standpoint about how to do this. It certainly sounds easy, but one of the big challenges of virtual care is the scheduling. And how do you schedule that and keep all of that, someone makes sense of all of that, so to speak, in the middle. But the virtual education is inevitable. It goes far beyond Zoom, which is a great company. And I think there's a lot of coordination of schedules that we're going to have to look at moving forward.
Part of it is also teaching clinicians how to teach using these types of devices again and use these types of visits. And in particular, the idea of helping teachers to learn how to think out loud so that the learner is able to understand their thinking process during these relatively short virtual visits has been a strategy I've seen work very well. But you have to have a pretty confident and capable clinician who's able to do that in front of a patient, while being sensitive to the patient's insights as to why they're doing that and how they're teaching our junior clinicians how they're thinking and solving problems on the fly.
Now, Graham, telehealth is, like we said, it's more widely available, but not everybody has access to technology and Wi-Fi. What capacity does telehealth have in filling the health gaps and inequities among marginalized groups?
Yeah, it's actually part of the remedy, I would say, to the inequities that persist. As I think you and many listeners will know, I practice in a FQHC and I practice endocrinology, largely diabetes care, transgender care, thyroid care, etc. And in many cases, the physical infrastructures that we have used for many years, a medical clinic, for example, is itself a substantial barrier to the engagement of marginalized communities. And actually, the availability and almost the ubiquitous availability, at least in places like North America, of a cell phone or at least a phone line is more accessible than requiring bus transport to a physical location. Similarly, if it's readily obvious to patients that their scheduling is more flexible, that can be accommodating to people whose schedules are much more challenging to manipulate to avoid losing a day's pay, for example, and telehealth facilitates that. So both in terms of scheduling and access and the availability of technology, even amongst the most marginalized in our community, means that I think telecare is actually a substantial part of the solution and is quite the opposite of a barrier.
The disparities of care has been very interesting. There's a lot that we're looking at right now in this area to see if telemedicine actually might have made the disparities worse inadvertently. And the jury is still out on that. we run a telemedicine tweet chat, and the hashtag is at telemednow, T-E-L-E-M-E-D now. And if you go to our website, which is telemed-now.org, we actually did a chat on disparities, and we had the transcript there. And there's a lot of concern about maybe increasing the disparities and how do we address that, certainly in rural and underserved populations, but as Graham knows far better than I, the urban underserved as well. So there's a tremendous amount of focus and attention on this area to make sure we don't make it worse, and some degree of concern.
What kind of factors do you think, Andrew, would make it worse? Given some of the liberating factors that are present, what are the factors that interfere with those and potentially stymie those?
I think there's a digital literacy component to this. The elderly, I think, are more at risk. In some degree, broadband connectivity. I have a house out near Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, where the seer of seers, Punxsutawney Phil, dwells, that we rely upon to predict the future. And I go out there routinely and just ride a dirt bike around the countryside, and you know, the cell phone signal is pretty shoddy out there, and I think that the companies have done a very good job of actually increasing the access, but it's certainly not 100%. But I think fundamentally it's just engagement of explaining to patients and others why this is important and how you use it, and we've just got to make it simpler for them. It's not fair to rely upon a lot of the urbanites or the younger folks that we use these gizmos way too much already and just assume everyone else can use it.
Yeah, it's very likely, I have to imagine, that services like 5G might actually elaborate some of these differences between communities, whether you have the updated equipment that can take it. And I suspect, in particular, home remote monitoring might be bandwidth intensive and create new demands for higher cost technology that's less accessible to those in who are most marginalized. So that could certainly exacerbate existing disparities. Would that be a fair deduction from what could be a risk to the future?
Yes, monitoring doesn't take that much, we've learned, just so you know. It's, but anyway, it's really a matter also how much does their data plan cost, and does a member or patient want to use video and consume their data plan's minutes.
So, yep.
Yeah.
The process of building trust between patients and clinicians, it changes in telehealth. Dr. Watson, how can education help clinicians learn to build trust when providing digital care?
This concept of trust is very hard to measure and evaluate, and it's been a challenge for healthcare, but just the basic fact that you're taking healthcare to their home, and Graham alluded to this earlier, they don't have to drive. We have the 9th worst interchange in the United States here in Pittsburgh, we're happy to say. The other 9 are in New York and Los Angeles. But we have many bridges, rivers, hills, traffic, tunnels, and it's hard to get to us. And so the ability in the winter months to not have to drive through rural Pennsylvania, or I discharged a patient today from Erie, and that's 5 hours in a car for hopefully a simple wound check. 5 hours is time, it's money, it's time off work, could be childcare, as Graham said. So you're building trust through convenience and access. And also, if it's easier to see somebody, you're also potentially able to see them more often, like more pulsatile care. And there's a lot to be said for that.
Graham, what training do clinicians need to be able to provide high quality telehealth services?
I think there's several key components. The first are pretty straightforward, which is how to use whatever technology platform is being leveraged by your clinic or your institution. The second is integrating your workflow with how you might use the EHR system or your record documentation system that you're using. The third is how to effectively communicate using video and avoid over-talking on a patient, which is a tendency for people on video that limits conversation and interaction. I think the fourth is how do you reformulate a traditional visit to accommodate the benefits of telehealth? How do you incorporate, for example, an inspection of a wound or an ocular examination, or use a remote monitoring device to give you information that you might not otherwise be able to obtain in person? I think the fifth then is around billing, to make sure that you're billing appropriately and accordingly and meeting the expectations of your financial responsibilities. And then the sixth is just thinking about longitudinality and the interaction of the patient using technology over the longer term, because a lot of what is available now in telecare allows longitudinal engagement with these patients using patient portals and other types of telecommunication between visits that facilitates the development of the relationship. those are things that would be top of mind for me. What am I missing, Andrew?
I think you got it all. That was a very thorough list. I think not talking over them and listening is very important.
And how have telehealth services helped physicians learn?
Yeah, I was thinking about that question, and it's just a new style of learning. And it's interesting how telehealth forces you to see patients and learn about them through the airwaves, so to speak. And it's the same for just basic education. And a lot of it is teaching us how to live in this new world where telemedicine forces us to do our jobs using video or monitoring, and education's going the same way, where the American College of Surgeons just had a dynamite conference. And I don't have to be there all the time, but I can go back later and look at a lot of the talks, which is very exciting and gives you a real opportunity. So it makes it more asynchronous. I think in general, there's a big setback because, as Graham talked about earlier, that peer-to-peer interaction in person is invaluable at these conferences, and you lose that. And people can be more distracted. Certainly, if you're sitting in your office for 8 hours of Zoom calls and you're on and get your ninth or tenth one, it can be harder to keep your focus. So the ability to do more asynchronous work is a real benefit. But without a doubt, it also gives you the ability to do more collaboration, where I actually had a video call with some of my friends from Oxford I haven't seen since 1993. And this whole virtual world made me say, hey, let's get together. And so it's really giving us a new way to connect with our peers and connect with our friends and learn from one another. So, you know, there's a plus and minus, but without a doubt, I would say net vector positive.
Graham, can you speak to some of the benefits of using synchronous versus asynchronous modalities?
Well, I think asynchronous modalities in particular speak to the value of using intermittent remote monitoring or interactions with patients that don't require, for example, live video. So in diabetology or diabetes care that I practice pretty routinely with my team, we interact with patients between visits using monitoring data from a continuous glucose monitor, for example, or a home weight monitor or a home blood pressure monitor uploaded to our portal. And that allows me then to message a patient saying, increase your dose here, or do this in response to this new piece of data. And that's a very important and valuable component of telecare, is this ability to interact with patients intermittently and digitally. But synchronous live activity interactions we've been talking about for most of this conversation and are a key part of replacing some of our old style of in-person only visits. And the more in which they can digitate and supplement the asynchronous visit and the digital interaction, the better we all are, because we know, just like learning is longitudinal, you need reinforcement and reminders to create consolidation of behavior and change. The same is true for all of our interactions with patients. The more they're reminded to do a certain thing, whether it's wound care or check their glucose or take their medicine or eat better or exercise or whatever it is that we need them to do, the more likely it is that they will actually do well with it, comply, and derive the benefits from the healthcare we can deploy and the technology we have at our hands now.
Graham, how does the regulatory structure accommodate the need to facilitate telehealth?
Boy, that's a toughie, and Dr. Watson certainly knows a lot more about this than I do, but it's been an unfortunate patchwork, to be honest. I mean, certainly several states during the COVID crisis have liberated access to telemedicine, but some have paradoxically and frustratingly closed down access where previously was available. I think many are looking to CMS in particular for leadership on this issue. If CMS opens up the field to cross-state and interstate medical care so that you can more closely align the skills the patient needs with the care that's available, you're more likely to see growth and development in the entire telemedicine field. But I think it is fair to recognize that both through payors and through state regulations, there are substantial challenges in creating a level playing field across the country to allow telemedicine to flourish to its maximal capacity. Is that a fair summary, Andrew?
It is, and it's a it's a tough question too. The answer is about as straight as the old crooked route. But there are some large buckets out there where you really have the executive branch and the legislative branch of our federal government have enormous impact through the executive orders that we saw. And once those are funded, they keep going typically, not all the time. And the legislative branch owns key issues such as the originating site and has a significant ability to impact the long-term provision of virtual care. HHS and CMS can also transform it through policy and regulatory changes by, for example, HHS amending the types of platforms, relaxing those rules, or looking at the OCR and not penalizing people for using platforms during the public health emergency. And after those organizations, you have the states that really control the standard of care in regional licensing. So there's about three or four different levels here that people are actually looking at. And a lot of our government relations, our GR teams, are very, very actively involved right now trying to help steer the ship right now, which is quite positive.
Dr. Watson, how would you like to see the CME community support telehealth?
Trying to focus on the ability of providing access to a lot of the recorded content where there are CME opportunities that a lot of these conferences and experts are putting online, but sometimes it can be hard to get access to those or the free recordings of them expire, and trying to create a way that the CME community can continue to support teleeducation, but also access to a lot of the core resources that are being created exponentially every single day. And those are really the main areas that I would see. And I don't know, Graham, you're probably more familiar with this than I am, what your thoughts would be.
Well, the world of education and CME is inevitably and permanently changed by the crisis. And just like we've been talking about the comfort of clinicians with providing telemedical care, the same has been true about learning virtually and digitally. There's been transformations there in both the culture and the strategy around engaging clinicians in professional development and performance improvement and training of all sorts. I would say that for the CME community to promote telemedicine specifically, I think the key issue is piercing the competence-confidence gap that exists for many clinicians in making assumptions about their ability to provide efficient, safe, and effective telemedical care. The bar may not be that high in terms of, or it's not that difficult to learn these skills, but there are real skills here that need to be learned to help clinicians be more effective. And I would like to see the CME community step up to help clinicians with modest training exercises that allow them to take advantage of these new services that they can deploy to the care of their patients.
Now we're coming up on our last couple of questions here. Dr. Andrew, what trends do you see for healthcare in the next 5 years?
Well, I'll have to go back to Punxsutawney and check with the groundhog. It's amazing how much it's going to change with likely a new administration and the consumer electronics market. I think we all know, in all seriousness, that the element of risk and value will continue to rise in importance, where this dependence upon fee-for-service, a lot of us on the payer side's hope will decrease. But in general, that there's going to be a much greater push towards virtual. We hope through virtual-first offerings from payers, a much more powerful suite of tools, biosensors that can be worn or purchased off a website like Amazon and delivered to home to get better bioparameters, as Graham knows as an endocrinologist. The entire world of diabetic care, there's so much you can do with glucometers and home sensing devices, is quite important. So I think at the highest level, it's again this journey towards value outside of just pure fee for service, which will evolve. And then on the telemedicine world, I think you'll see a significant rise in the value of telemedicine that will be augmented with one of the telemedicine pieces, remote monitoring. And, you know, stand by, there are big changes to come. And I think the employers are going to have a very large say in what direction this takes, which they should.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Watson. And Graham, thank you as always for your insight. And I look forward to seeing how telehealth and telemedicine develops in the coming future.
You and me both. We're all excited about the changes that are afoot, and hopefully we're part of the solution.
And I'm very grateful to all of you folks for the questions, and also to the ACCME for all that it does to educate us and in its support of telemedicine. So thank you so much, and a real privilege and pleasure to be here. Thanks so much.
If you enjoy this conversation, we're always looking to extend the discussion on CME. Feel free to reach out with topics you'd like us to cover, or let us know how you're addressing these issues in your organization. Thank you for listening, and catch us on the next episode of Coffee with Graham.